Okay, welcome everybody to the PhoneBridge workshop that we're having today. Today we're going to be focusing on how to stay abstinent during this shelter-in-place pandemic that we're experiencing here in 2020. And before we get started, let's begin with the Serenity Prayer. God, grant me the serenity.
Grant me the serenity.
Accept the things I cannot change.
I cannot change.
The courage to change the things I can.
And the wisdom to never give up.
Know the difference.
Friends. Thy will, not mine, be done. Amen.
Okay, thank you. Okay, again, my name is Linda M. I am a compulsive eater and a very grateful member of CHOW. These are very strange and unfamiliar times here in 2020. We've spent the past 6 months, since mid-March, in a lockdown, in a shelter in place, and so many things have been happening in the world. Sometimes I feel like I'm in a movie, and I'm not sure what to do, how to manage moving around the world and my household and with my neighbors and people out in the world in general. And to me, as a member of CHOW, I believe that we are uniquely prepared to accept powerlessness, which is the very first step. And I believe that, you know, again, CHOW is uniquely prepared for support because we have phone bridge meetings. I mean, we've had those, right? And leader, I mean, we were all set with that. CHOW also has the electronic intergroup English, which there have been a couple of Zoom meetings for several years. I mean, I think it started when I came into program. It was just getting started. So we already have that in place. And we have so many folks that jumped in and started Zoom meetings all across the country, the world. There's Zoom meetings in England. Today we're going to have six speakers, and they're going to discuss their experience as compulsive eaters and how the program has helped them to stay abstinent during this shelter in place, the strength that they have, that they found. And so we are going to start off with Adele. And are you on the line?
Thank you, Linda.
Yeah,
hi, it's Adele, compulsive overeater, believe it, and I'm going, you're probably saying, oh my gosh, she did the last workshop and stuff on the seven tools, and the only reason I did it this time, you know, I did not ask to do it, but Linda asked me to do it because of my experience that I've had during the pandemic. And I'm supposed to tell you what I was like before, see how it's, boy, I didn't start gaining weight. Well, I guess I was a compulsive overeater way before I even gained weight because I used to steal food out of the refrigerator when it wasn't meal time, and I stole something from the store and got blackballed. And we used to, you know, where we lived at, it was, you know, different trees. We used to walk around and just pick stuff off people's trees without asking, and, you know, it was stealing, even though, you know, there's no excuse, it was stealing. And so, I think my first, I tried some white pills before in the 70s, and I, you know, look back at a picture, you know, I can remember now a picture that I look back, I really didn't need to lose weight. I was just, you know, crazy and married to somebody that was using and abusing, and, you know, so it was, yes, just a lot of craziness going on, but, you know, I added to the crazy. I came from crazy, and so naturally, I was still, you know, I was crazy regardless of what was going on with my husband. But I remember in Vegas, we had moved from Northern California to Vegas, and with my first kid, I only picked up 25 pounds, which is the normal weight. And then with my second kid, I think I picked up more than the 25 pounds. And I can't remember whether I was on the Dr. Atlas diet, and I, you know, they let you have all this greasy stuff. And I remember being on the floor in a fetal position because I was so sick from eating, you know, because you can eat as much as you want. There wasn't a limit. And so I was just so sick, and you know, you would think I would never try that diet again, but I did try it again years later. And when I had my last kid, I weighed, I'm 5'9", well, I don't know, I used to go between 5'9" and 5'10", so I don't know where I was at when I had my last kid, but I weighed 204. And I think I'm going to have this big old baby, and I have been eating a lot of sugary stuff with her, and she don't like sugary stuff as an adult and stuff. I burnt her out. And it's really weird with the second kid. I ate really good, and she's a carbon copy of me. She loves sugar like her mom, and she's just me all over. And so, okay, where was I going with this? So with my, after I had my kid, I mean, I'm thinking I'm going to have this big baby, and I was 204, and she came out 8'1", and I was 190-some pounds, so I didn't lose, all I did was lose her, and, but I'm 5'9", and, you know, and sometimes, you know, you carry your weight good when you're taller, and so, but I have tried many diets, Herbalife, Weight Watcher, and even with Weight Watcher, I got to Lifetime, and then I started playing with it. I started going out, eating what I wanted to eat, and then right before weigh-in time, do a laxative, and I tried, you know, use my mama water pills. So, you know, I just was a nutcase. always training. You know, some people say, you don't need to lose weight, you look good, but I didn't like how I look, and sometimes my knees would hurt. And so, how I found this program, I found it in, I think the end of 88, I found OA first, and it just didn't work for me. I needed more structure. You can't do this, you can do that. And so I came in, I still have my first notebook from when I came in, and my first sponsor is on the phone right now. My first day of abstinence back in 89 was January the 2nd. And I had my weight down, but I really didn't need to lose weight, but I was out of control with food. And so I'm looking at kind of keep the eye on the time too. So I know that I was crazy because my daughter had went somewhere and they had made some sugar stuff and she came home and she gave me this thin slice and I wanted more and she wouldn't give it to me. And I think she was only 11 or 12 years old then, and you know, I knew I was crazy then when you get mad at somebody about their food. And I was so used to being in control of, you know, the food in the house because I was the provider. And so yeah, so I ended up finding this program, and then I did my fourth step. The fourth step always scared me because even before I touched any 12-step program, because I had dated somebody that was doing a fourth step and said they had to tell their sponsor what they did. So I go, heck no, you know, because in the old, you know, this old school is you don't tell secrets and stuff, and so I didn't ever do one in my first program, but when I came here, I just did the next syndicated step, and I felt like boulders had fell off my shoulders, and then that's all I did was step five, and I just stopped and started playing games with the program. I used to say, oh, I'm going to go and have this, and then I'll come back, and I'll have this and that. So it was a lot of years in and out from, what was that, 87, probably in the 90s until I ended up with high blood pressure in 2004, and then I got more serious, and I did have a slip in 2007. And so so I'm just going to go into the part about, about staying absent during the last 6 months. When this came down, I had to schedule a trip to Washington. I had some free miles that I needed, wanted to get rid of, and had some points to use at hotels. And I was going to go up there and hang out with a program friend and one of my friends from program. We was going to go over to Canada to a meeting in Canada, see how a meeting in Canada. And so, you know, all that came to a stop in, I think, in February, because I was scheduled to fly out in March. And it was just for fun and for free. So I ended up canceling that trip, and then as it went on, the first weekend when they were saying that we needed to shelter in place, and I didn't have a lot of things that I'm supposed to have for our program, and I had called this one store that I was just there Tuesday, and they had, you know, they had food galore, they, you know, a big store. And I called them that Saturday morning, and she told me the line was like 3 to 5 hours long, and they didn't have a lot of stuff. And so I had called my sponsor and told her that I'm short on, I think I can say vegetables. And she said, that's not an option. And so I had to go and hunt some, you know, go to the store and hunt some stuff down. And, you know, God was good to me. The first store I went to had some stuff, and, you know, didn't have everything that I wanted, but they had stuff. And then I went over to another store. And so, you know, when your sponsor tells you it's not an option to run out of something, you know you got to get busy and get out there and start searching. And so during the pandemic, I did make a 100 to-do list of things to do around the house. And, you know, most of it got taken care of. And then I ended up getting sick on the week before the 18th of oh my God, I can't even think, the 18th of July, and that Friday I was getting pretty bad, and my acupuncturist told me whenever your tongue is white, you got something going on in your body, and that Thursday my tongue was white, and so it's like that Friday, it's like, oh, you know, maybe I can go to the hospital after this Zoom baby shower, and oh, maybe I can wait to Sunday and do it after the workshop, that was the 7-2 workshop. And that Friday night, it was in so much pain. It was like, okay. So I ended up, and that's the last place I wanted to be, was in the hospital. And I hadn't even been letting people into my house, you know, people, delivery bring grocery, and I would have them leave it outside the door. And one guy one time needed his bag, and I'm going, you know, I can't let you in. And so, you know, I was really kind of staying away from people. And, you know, to have to go to the hospital, but I was in so much pain, I couldn't, you know, bear it. And so on the 18th, you know, that morning I got up and I worked on the 7 tools that had already put a lot of stuff together. So I ended up working on that some while I was waiting to call my friend to take me to the hospital. And so thinking it was my appendix, but it ended up being an abscess in my stomach. And so, yeah, I was in the hospital, and they kept saying, oh, we can't do nothing about it. It's in between, you know, this and that, and, you know, we'll just give you antibiotics. You can go home, and then the next day, no, you can't go home. So it was a long back and forth from the 18. Well, one time I could go home because they said, I went in on a Saturday, the people that could do something, I can't remember whether it was a ultrasound or what, wouldn't be into Monday, but I was in so much pain, I'm glad I stayed because I was on morphine, and, you know, that's the only way you can really get morphine and get rid of the pain is being in the hospital. And so what happened was I, you know, we went back and forth, you know, with, you know, you don't need surgery, you need surgery. So on the 28th of July, they did do surgery. And on the 24th, when we had our conference, and it was so weird because I usually eat breakfast about 10 when I'm at the hospital, and that morning I decided to eat breakfast at 7-something, and when they came in to take some to take some pictures of my heart because they had seen something in, around my heart, they couldn't do it because I had just had the food. So that mean I was able to participate in the and the conference because I was a delegate. So it was like, that's, it's like, wow, that's really, you know, that was God. You know, that was God all over because, you know, like I said, I didn't eat breakfast to 10 something. So while I was in the hospital, I lost some, I just couldn't keep food down. I had to work with what they had there, and I did have a friend bring me some stuff. I had her bring me stuff a couple of times, and I ended up spending my birthday, my belly button birthday, in the hospital, and you know, that was no fun, but I came into acceptance with that. I was talking to somebody, it's like, oh, you know, you was born in a hospital, so you get a chance to spend your 66th birthday in the hospital too. And you know, and God, you know, had my two grandkids come, even though they couldn't come in. My grandson knew I was facing the north window, I mean, the mountains, so he parked over there, and I was able to see him and his sister. And they couldn't see but a little white spot in the window for me, and we talked on the phone. So that was the highlight of my birthday, and they brought me some decor, some balloons, and flowers and butterflies that stick on the wall. And so, yeah, the food was an issue. I did have to, the first day after surgery, I couldn't eat at all. The second day after surgery, all I could have was ice chip. The day of surgery, I couldn't have nothing. So it's day of surgery, nothing. The next day, nothing. Then ice chip, and then sip of water. So they had to give me something to keep me from going into starvation. And I've been kind of embarrassed to share about that. But, you know, I did ask them, did they have sugar-free? And they said no. And so it was a medical abstinence. You know, it was, you know, either lay there and say, no, I can't have it and go into starvation. So I had to do what the doctor said that I needed to do. And I need to not be embarrassed about that because, I have no control. And where I am right now, you know, I got out of the hospital on the 13th of August. And it's some food that I can eat in the morning time, I can stand in the evening time. Some food that, I was even throwing up the throw up, you know. Again, so it's been a journey. And right now, you know, I am 20 pounds under where I was maybe the week before I got sick. And so I'm working with a dietitian right now because I can't seem to pick up weight. And I just got to trust my higher power. Everything is just like it's supposed to be. And I just need to do what she... Okay, thank you, Linda. Do what she tell me to do. And I just talked to my sponsor this morning because she want me to have something a little bit more than I should have at breakfast. But by me being on 8 maintenance, I can have it at lunch and dinner. So, and I'm planning on talking to the dietitian again tomorrow. And it's been a journey, you know. The meetings have been keeping me sane. The conference that we had, I'm glad that I was able to participate in that and not worry about the procedure that I needed to have. And the surgery, you know, I ended up being able to listen to meetings before I had surgery because they were squeezing me in, so they didn't have a particular time. And that's how I say it, abstinence, and, you know, I'm still abstinence, even though that, I'm losing weight. And it's weird, the nurse that was coming out every day, she was saying, you need to get on the scale every day. And it's like, that's my old behavior, you know, before program is on that scale every day. And so I did it for a couple of days, and then I stopped, and the next thing I knew, I had lost like 10 pounds in about 10 days, and so I, you know, started doing what she told me to do, but now the dietitian only want me to weigh once a week. So I'm just doing my food plan to the best of my ability, and, I have to throw away so much food because, I tell my sponsor I'm going to have this, and I taste it, and make me want to throw up, and so then I have to, you know, change it to something else, and so, I have not had anything outside the rim and stuff. And in the hospital, you know, you really can't measure a lot of the stuff. You have to kind of like eyeball it and stuff. And, sometimes I just couldn't even eat what I could have on program. And that's the same thing now. I can't, my stomach gets so full so fast. I did have a small piece of my intestine removed. And I came home on 4 different antibiotics, and so that really messed up with my taste, but to not be able to taste food. And but I'm here, you know. The one good thing is I'm still on this side of the grass, and I still attend my meetings, and you know, I wasn't able to work the 7/2s according because, you know, some days I was, you know, day after surgery, all I could do was wake up and, you know, get pain pills. And for some reason, I kept touching my nose. I don't know what that was about the day after surgery, but that's all I can remember, waking up and get pain medication and touching my nose. But I think that's enough for me. And thank you so much for letting me share, Linda. And I'll mute and listen to the rest of the 5 speakers.
Thank you so very much, Adele. And I can hear that there's applause here in the silence. Okay, our next person coming up is Sonia Sunshine.
I can be heard?
Yes. How would you like to be timed?
Let me know when I have 5 minutes left. And then let me know when I have 2 minutes left, please.
You got it.
Thank you. Hi, I'm Sonia, and my middle name is Sunshine. I'm a grateful, recovering, compulsive overeater. I am currently in Los Angeles, California. This workshop, I'm so honored that I was asked that I am supposed to tell you what it was like, what happened, and what I'm like now, and how I use my program to stay abstinent. And I haven't thought out, and it's supposed to be about COVID-19 is the prompt I had. Is that correct? Is anyone?
Yes. Yeah, and how you stayed abstinent.
Through COVID-19. Well, a lot of you who don't know me is I like to just get a little history in. I am the youngest of six, and I come from a very colorful childhood, to say the least. And it was always around food. A lot of the food stuff started very early in my childhood. And there wasn't enough food, but my siblings would steal my food from my plate. It was just this whole thing around if I wanted to be heard, the only time to talk was during a mealtime, and then they weren't really listening to me. They were kind of stealing my food, going, and they would laugh at each other. So this is a big thing through my life of not being heard, or what I have to say doesn't matter unless I'm manipulating them, because my mom knew this was going on and she'd have another plate for me in the kitchen. So I let them think they were starving me, but they really weren't. Anyway, that's a big point in my life. And I think compulsive overeating started at a very young age. And in my family, we were very much athletes, all of us, and we were pushed to be athletes. But there wasn't any restrictions with food, and there wasn't any dieting or anything. Very Russian, Polish childhood, and I don't know if you know about these Russians and Poles where you're doing, like, gymnastics on the beach and everyone's doing all this. It's, like, always physical. So then what happened is if you ate too much, it wasn't, you know, that they tried to starve us. It was go swim some laps, go run. Look at that stomach. You got to go do a sport. You know. So that's what I heard. And but there was never any education or limiting of the food or the carbs or the fats, or there was no diet thinking. And I remember for the first time I heard from someone that they don't eat bread and that they only eat vegetables with their protein. And I was in middle school, and I told my mom, I only want this one vegetable with protein. Don't give me anything else on my plate. No starches, anything. And then I would run a couple times a week, and I was losing weight. And I remember feeling all these feelings that were so overwhelming, and I couldn't deal with them because I didn't have any tools, and I didn't have a way of dealing with them. So the whole thing from that is I started going into drugs at a very young age, at like age 12, and I started using pot and in order to drown the pain, and other pills that my friend's mother was a dealer. And I would stay at her house for like a week or two at a time, and it was drinking. And so by the time I was in my teens, I was a full-blown alcoholic addict, somewhat functioning, but not really. And I was always hanging out with people 15, 20 years a fake ID, and doing this crazy stuff like going to Florida Keys for 2 weeks and then on a binge and not remembering it. And a lot of it was starving and using drugs. And that's part of my story. So what happened is in 1980, about 38 years ago, a sister of mine started losing weight by going to Overeaters Anonymous. And all I know is she kept talking about the size of jeans. She was going down from a 12 to a 10 to an 8 to a 6. And she was like, oh, this is so easy. And then I'm like, take me wherever you're going, take me. And I had like 20 pounds to lose at that time. And so I've been coming back to program and using exercise and diet, and I never really got into the steps until finally someone said, you're too angry, work the steps. And I was so mad at her for months, and then I complained to a friend of mine, and they finally explained to me what the steps were, what a big book was it 12 and 12 was, and why they don't diet. And I always, you know, liked that about how, you know, a lot of people would come into our meetings just to get the food plan. And they were trainers, or they were from another 12-step program. And I would know them because I've been around for years, and they're like, well, Sonia, to be honest with you, I'm sponsoring people, and this literature is the best to bring them to the big book in the 12 and 12. And a lot of people in other 12-step programs don't have this format like this. So anyway, I just thought I'd let you guys know about that. And so I was self-supporting by age. I left Florida and lived with my sister at age 2. No, I'm just kidding, you guys. At age 14, and I worked a job while I went to school, and by 16, I was, like, supporting the household because I had 2 jobs, and I went to, like, 2 classes. The reason I'm bringing all that up is in my jumping forward, when I got older, I got up to going in and out of program. I got up to a size 26, and I was over 180 pounds overweight. I got up to 330. Now, meanwhile, I had never been any higher than 150 my whole life, being 5'6", around there. And I did empowerment workshops and self-esteem workshops for a living. So I was at this level of denial that I'm going to be a big and tall model. And I just kept getting bigger and bigger. And then people started reacting when they saw me, people who had known me, and would run away like so shocked that it was even me. I had that happen to me by a very handsome guy. I went and I looked in the mirror going, you know, I love who you are. Because I do these empowerment workshops, but the reason I'm talking about it is I call it dishonest honesty. I was being so honest and finding a way to love myself that I was dishonest. And finally, you know, I found my way back to really working the program. I never really left. I would go to a meeting maybe once every 2 months, but I never was really working the program. So I know the capabilities of me getting back up there. I currently have an abstinence of 3 years of 8 months of a recommitted abstinence, and I'm maintaining 125-pound weight loss with God's help and all of you. And in February, one of my dearest brothers passed away, and we went to the funeral in Kauai. And it was one of the most toxic family interactions going on because family members weren't talking. And I worked, I have a teenager that I had doing his homework virtually while we were there and dealing with the family and working a program, calling my sponsor, weighing and measuring my food from a hotel room because my sponsor in Al-Anon said you cannot stay with your family through this. And this is before COVID, like a week before COVID. And that my family was fighting so badly that, you know, in Kauai you have a paddle out. And you, you know, with for surfers. And at the same beach, they were going to have two separate funerals they were announcing on the media and Facebook. And,
10 minutes.
God, thank you. That's 5 minutes left. Thank you. And God told me you need to go there and just heal that. And I booked a trip Thursday night to get there on Friday. The funeral was Saturday. And so when I came back from the funeral and we went into COVID, it was like I run two businesses. I'm a single mom, a widow of a teenager who I now have to homeschool. I have my own clients on Zoom, and I'm still grieving my brother. And I'm working a program 24/7 out of my house, and it was not easy. The thing that I kept doing was, you know, if you fail to plan, then you're going to plan to fail. And I just kept having my grocery list. I would wait, get there early, do the grocery shopping. I would do the cooking 2 days a week of all of my veggies and what I needed and my protein. So I didn't have to go into the kitchen and do big meals every day. And I completed my food. I worked a question, and I stayed. So what happened is my program, oh, and plus, I didn't tell a lot of you, I'm in graduate school on top of it. Did I tell you that? To get my master's as an MFT, and I'm in a training ship. So here I am doing a training ship on Zoom, a couple clients I don't get paid for to get my hours, and I'm trying to homeschool a teenager. Well, the truth is his grades started failing. I was like saying, well, he was lying about doing his homework, and when the grades came, I was shocked that I have to micromanage. So I asked for help, and I actually got him out of the house. He and said, because he was doing screen addiction, and instead of doing his homework, he was doing video games. And I never understood that because we had a no TV household. So at 14, he got a Nintendo Switch, and I, like, lost my son. So I asked for help with family and friends and his godparents, and they said, we'll take him, which was, I just have to tell you guys, for me not to be able to figure something out. And so what I want to tell you about all that is, after I got him out of the house, all of a sudden there was an assignment for a group I was in, and the group poked. They just said, let's pick screen addiction. And it helped me realize that, you know, my son had spent like $1,000 out of my account on some game. And I'm like, that's not my son. He's, you know, and it really made me understand that he's not doing this to me. Just like with the food and my addictions, I'm clean and sober. I'm going to be 34. I'm 33 years clean and sober, and it's not like I'm doing it. My disease has changed over the years, and it's slick, and it finds ways to pull me out. And I always tell people, one thing I've always done is know my disease and how it talks to me. And my disease was, you're not a good mother if you get your son out of your house. Then you're weak, and you're pitiful. And I prayed and prayed, thank you. And my sponsor said, you need help. Get your son out of your house. And I did it. She said, you know, I've been sponsoring people for like 20 years. You're the first person that has done it the first time I've said it. And, you know, they're like, he's an addict and you can't help him. And it was like, I just, because I was clear enough in my recovery, I knew I'm not bad. I just couldn't help him. And there's no way if I give up my recovery and my program and my abstinence And, you know, the thing is I probably could have helped him if I was into the sugar, the flour, the alcohol, the downers. Then I could help him. But for me, to make my recovery the most important thing, not only helped me, helped my son. He's gotten all A's. He's doing really great. And him and I went paddle boarding yesterday. Now, this is someone that couldn't, I couldn't even walk a block when I was at 330 pounds. So it's a miracle of this program that I could do all these activities and be physical with my son. And when I travel, I pack my food. You know, I plan every day that I don't want to go back to that hopeless, angry, self-pity place. It's a disease that wants to kill me, and it's doing push-ups every day. And if I'm not doing my actions every day of the seven tools, and, you know, I sponsor a lot of people, and a lot of them, you know, say, well, I'm doing everything. Why isn't this working? Well, sometimes I find people use this program, including myself, as a diet. But the only thing that helps me is when I have this spiritual experience and I say, I can't, God can. I just have to let him. And I had, that's the thing, is always go have a home group, do a lot of service. That's the thing I've done this time back. Is I'm a selfish, self-centered addict. And I started reading at every meeting, even if I wasn't abstinent. I'm now secretary of two meetings. I'm on committees. I do committees at the convention. And I never wanted to be a real part of this program and give back. But Ray Zeed, one of the co-founders, you know, no matter what was going on, when I would call her, she goes, and how are you today, dear? And that's the thing I've learned, is to get out of myself and ask others, and how are you today, no matter what's going on, and let people know what's really going on with me. The woman that asked me to speak was like, oh, you're saying abstinent, and you have a son, and you're in COVID-19. Well, she didn't know I asked for help. And that's how I'm staying abstinent. Right now, I'm with my son for the weekend with another teenager, and they're eating all this other stuff around us. But for me, it's just none of my business. It's not my food. And I stay on my food plan. I try to eat at the same time every day. And that keeps my life boring in a healthy way. Because from where I come from, a hopeless addict, staying out on two-week runs, starving, and then binging. Boredom for me is a gift. And there's no big deals that God can't handle. You know, so what I want to end you guys with is just, you know, have a sponsor. Even if it's an interim while you're finding a sponsor. You know, I like to sponsor people for 2 weeks till they find someone. I always keep a slot open for that. But have a sponsor, know when your home group meeting is, that you go to every week and that you do service at. Know what step you're on. And the last thing I want to say is make sure that you're making abstinence the most important thing in your life, without a doubt. And that's what has helped me. Thank you for letting me share. I think that's my time, right?
It is. Minutes.
Okay.
It is.
Thank you for letting me share. Okay. Bye-bye.
Thank you so much, Sonia Sunshine. And our next speaker is Suzanne Kay. And are you here with us?
Hi, yes, hi. Good Thanks morning. So much for asking me to speak. This is Suzanne Kay. I'm a very, very grateful compulsive eater.
Suzanne, how would you like me to time you?
I think the 5 minutes left and 2 minutes left, that would sound good to me.
Okay, great. Thank you.
Okay, and so Suzanne Kay here. I came into this program very desperate, but in the very beginning, when I did come in, I went to another program first, and what brought me into the program, believe it or not, was getting involved with someone that had a rifle at my chest and wanted my purse. And I started screaming, and I thought I wasn't going to be here the next minute, and he told me what he wanted. I threw him my purse, and out comes these people from a room, and it happened to be a 12-step room with a meeting in it, which was amazing. They took me in. We called the police, and the reason why that I'm saying this to you is because of this event, I was just screaming, and all of my emotions came to surface from all these years of stuffing everything down with the food. I think I was a compulsive eater at the get-go out of my mom's tummy, really. And both my mom and dad's tummy were pretty big. They were both over 200 pounds. I started in this program at 226. my mom ended up getting late-onset diabetes and heart disease, and she passed away at the age of 76 in a wheelchair for 7 years with my dad, who is now 97, pushing her around in the wheelchair. And the reason why I'm saying this is because when I came into this program, I tried all the diets you could imagine, you know, the urine from whatever animal it was, and I actually went on a liquid protein diet. I did not eat for 6 months. I drank just this drink, and I got down to a size 4, and I thought that was so fantastic. And then within probably around 3 or 4 months, I gained all my weight back. And that was what I did during my whole childhood, was I would lose the weight and put it on, lose the weight and put it on. My mom was really concerned about me. I thought that she was just being real controlling. And she said, you know, fat girls, to me, I heard it in my head, fat girls don't wear anything except for black, brown, and blue. And I wasn't able to wear a pair of jeans because, you know, that would make me look too fat. And my mom wanted me to look nice. And I had a real, you know, bad problem with isolation when I was younger. I changed my name from Suzanne to Sue so that when my mom forced me to introduce myself at school, I could say, "Hi, my name's Sue," and instead of Suzanne, so that I could get it over real quick, and then they'd take a look at me and start talking to their friends, and that would be it. And so during my whole school years, I really only had two friends all the way through high school. Anyway, I was very shy, and I went away to camp, and the only thing that I did was do laps in the pool so that I didn't have to talk to everybody, and that actually made my weight go down a little bit, too, so that was kind of cool. I come from a family of, not to do their inventory, but overeaters. The only one that was thin in my family was my sister, and I always felt very compared to her, that she was the thin sister, and I was the fat sister. She was more smart, and I wasn't. And it's funny today, though, when I talk to her, she didn't see it that way at all, and actually, she thought she was overweight. So It's very interesting the way that I thought when I was growing up. And after I came into program and I did my steps and my inventories and everything, I really did realize that my mom and dad really loved me, and they weren't doing anything to me to make me feel bad. So moving forward, the tipping point for me to get in 12-step was that rifle at my chest, and then I started going to another program, which actually does help me today, which I will say because it's part of my story. It is Al-Anon. And when I went into that program, I was talking about my weight, you know, and this wonderful, I call her Angel, asked me one day after the meeting, do you think that you'd like to come with me to this food program that I go to? And I thought, well, okay, because I wasn't feeling very good about my weight. And I went, and lo and behold, it was CEA Hal. And I went in there, and I saw everybody qualifying, how many days and years and months that they had, and one lady was almost like, I don't know, 17 years or more, and I was looking at everybody and thinking, well, how do you do this? You know, this is crazy. And they said, well, you have to get a sponsor, you know. So, of course, I did what I was told. I got a sponsor. I ran out of the room, and I don't even know who I picked. I never called them. I can't even do an amends. And I thought, well, I am not going to do this because all I'm going to do is fail again. And I thought, no, not for me. I was going on a cruise in December anyway, and I knew what I was going to do when I went there. So anyway, I did go on that cruise. There were 12-step meetings on that cruise, which there are on most cruises. And I did find someone that was in another program that was very similar to our program. And I was watching her the whole time on the cruise, how she ate, as I was shoveling things down my throat. And but I think it did stick with me. So, and I also decided that I was just going to start eating after I went to that first meeting because nothing ever worked, and I always gained my weight back. And I was going to end up like my mom in the wheelchair anyway, so I might as well just have some fun, you know. And so I did. It started out with that cruise. And I ate and ate and ate. I went home and ate some more. And then I started walking up the stairs of my house. And I couldn't even get up like 8 stairs without stopping in the middle and huffing and puffing. And that was like a real wake-up call for me because I really felt like I was going to be in that wheelchair like my mom. And I have a lot of longevity in my family. My grandparents lived into their 90s. My dad's 97 right now. And I thought, wow, I don't know if I really want to do that for so many years in a wheelchair, you know. So when I did go to my next 12-step meeting, the same wonderful angel came up to me. It was a couple, you know, like a month or so later, a couple months later. And she said, well, would you like to come back to CEA Hal, you know, and go to a meeting with me? So I did it again. I went in. But this time, I really saw the recovery in the room. And I saw people smiling. And I didn't do much of that. I was very kind of shy, and I was not usually in a mood to smile, always worrying about my weight and how heavy I was. And so this one lady got up, and she was really adamant about her program, and she had had a stroke, and she said, and this program saved my life, and I'm going to, you know, do this for the rest of my life. And she kind of scared me. So, and she didn't say she was available.
So
5 minutes.
Anyway, after the meeting, is that some time?
Yeah, five more minutes.
5 more minutes. Okay, anyway, long story short, I did actually be with her, and then she was a good sponsor for me. We had to break our ways at 11 months on, and I got with another sponsor who brought me into service right away, and I did end up going on another cruise. And I stayed abstinent. I actually had to take things off of I didn't have enough of my vegetables, so I actually stole some and took them back to my room to do whatever it took to stay on my program because everything was closed down. Now, in the last 6 months of the program now, a lot of things have happened. I've had to change locations from L.A. to Las Vegas to be more safe. My ex-husband just passed away from fourth stage cancer. I'm having health concerns right now. I have really, it's been a blessing. COVID has been a blessing to me. I went all the way to maintenance in my first 14 months, and then about a year ago, I creeped up in my weight, still staying abstinent, but not being willing to give up some of the abstinent foods. Now I'm back down to under my maintenance weight. I have been very blessed through COVID because, thank goodness, I am on Social Security. It is difficult for me because I lost my 1 day of a week job, but I started walking 2 hours a day, and because of my health concerns, I needed to give up a lot of foods that were really not good for me, everything from dairy to my coffee to sweeteners to salt to most oils, and I'm still doing wonderfully. I'm working with a great sponsor. I just want to say that I am so grateful, and I do a grateful list every morning. And the one thing that I'm trying to do during all this is get into humor. You know, we're not supposed to be a glum lot, it says, you know, in our book. And that's a real hard one for me. But the last thing that I want to say is whoever is listening, there is hope. There is an experience, strength, and hope in this program. If you keep coming back, you're going to do everything that you need to do. And really, it's not whether you're knocked down, how much time you have, whether you get up, but it just get up, move forward, and trust that higher power is in charge. He's never let me down. He's never done anything to drop me on my head. And all throughout my whole life, I've always been protected by him, even in the hardest of times that we're going through right now. So anyway, I love you all. I'm going to be in program now. I'm in 11 years, 7 months, 23 days, and I'm hoping to get to my 12th month on January 20th of next year, and I will one way or the other. And if I have to fall down and get back up and regroup and move forward, I have so many people here that are going to help me to do that. And that is the real big blessing of this program. We're not doing it alone. It's a we program, not a me program. So thank you for letting me share, everyone, and have a very safe and wonderful day and rest of the week. And thanks so much for letting me share.
Thank you, Suzanne Kay. Thank you so very much. And Next up, we're going to have Tom. Tom P. And you'll have to press star 6 to unmute.
Oh, no, I'm here. I already unmuted, awesome. Hopefully.
Yeah, okay. We got
it. Hi.
How would you like to be timed?
I guess just give me 1 minute warning before the end of the time.
Okay.
Okay, so just let it go the whole time and then just give me 1 minute.
Okay.
So I'm Tom P. I live in West Hollywood, California. My abstinent day is March the 13th of 1991, which translates into 29 years and 6 months as of today. I've given away and been maintaining 150-pound weight loss for 28 years of that time. It took me a little over a year to lose all my 150 pounds. So, you know, I've been around for a long time. I also want to let people know that I am one of the original people who helped form CHOW. I was in the initial, what they call the bylaws committee, who created CHOW back in the day when Overeaters Anonymous asked the HOW meetings to no longer associate themselves with Overeaters Anonymous. So I've been a very big part of this organization's structure and formation for a very long time. I got involved in service very early, and Ray Z, one of the co-founders of CHOW, kind of saw something in me or something, and she kind of convinced me to get more involved at the intergroup level many, many years ago. So that's made a big difference in my life because I realized that I wasn't in charge and that I could focus on helping people be focused on what it is we need to talk about. And I got that through this program. I mean, really, that's what I really got from this program. I came to this program not necessarily thinking, oh, I need to find... Ryan tricked me to go to my very first meeting. She said that she wanted to go to a movie with me because we had started working together. And she goes, let's go to a movie. And so I said, okay. She goes, oh, but I have to go to a meeting first. Why don't you come with me? So I begrudgingly went because I was someone who, you know, wants to make everyone happy. I can't make anyone unhappy. I'm one of the good little boys who has to make everyone, you know, be happy. So I didn't say no. So I went to my very first meeting. I did not stand up as a newcomer. I was too ashamed. But I will say that first meeting kind of, I think, planted the seed of hope. And I hope that's what other people maybe get from going to a meeting, is hearing the seed of hope that, you know, it can be different. What really freaked me out was that people were talking about what was going on in their lives and they weren't eating over it. Because that was my main focus in my family. That was how I coped. I was just listening to the woman prior to myself about, you know, her family was overweight, and my parents really weren't overweight, but my mother was always obsessed with her weight because she always said she was 20 pounds overweight, but I never really saw any change in her one way or the other, so I don't know, but she was just obsessed with her weight the whole time my growing up. So I think somehow that was transferred to me and my struggles around food. Since I've lost my weight, it's really been interesting. My sister, who was always thin my whole life, is now overweight. And so there's some reason in my family, one of us, either my sister or myself, has got to be overweight. It's kind of an interesting thing that I've seen happen over time. When I, you know, as I said, I wasn't someone who came to the program and said hallelujah. I found the answer, but I did go to meetings for a long time. Finally, for me, I put down the food, and for me, that's the most important element for being in a food recovery program, is to put down my substance of use, or use of, my substance that I use to cope with life. So I put down my food, and I started to lose weight, and you know, that was a nice thing, but for me, what was more important was finding sanity in my life. I had a freedom of not being so obsessed with the food and being obsessed with my own thoughts about what was going on in my life. I do remember when I was in around 9 months of recovery, I was standing in the middle of my kitchen, and I just remember stopped and I said to myself, God, I can't do this anymore. And I don't know what it was or what was so terrible that was going on at that moment, but I remember having a sense of feeling that went through my entire body, of starting like the top of my head, going down to my feet, that I'm going to be okay no matter what happens. And I have never lost that feeling the entire time I've been in recovery. I've had struggles, and I haven't lost my abstinence since I've been in recovery. I've, you know, been doing this for the whole time I've been here. I should say, when I put down the food. Because I've actually been around the program for probably around 31 years, but I was just going to meetings for the first year and a half of not doing anything. I was just going to meetings. But for me, that was important because I was listening and I was hearing people in recovery, and I needed to hear that. That was the most important thing for me, is I needed to know that there was an alternative to what I was doing, which was just eating constantly and covering up the feelings that I was having. I didn't really know that I had feelings. I still, to this day, struggle with feelings. I'm someone who wants to run away from everything. I haven't given up, though. That's one of the best things about being in recovery for such a long time, is I haven't given up. Yes, I struggle around sometimes wanting to run away, but I don't. I may say I want to run away, but I don't act on it, which to me is a very, very, you know, important thing. I think it's important to say what I'm feeling. I just don't have to act on it. And so that's been a big key that I've learned over time, is that, yes, I can say that I want to stop doing things and not, you know, I don't feel that I'm getting anything from this or whatever, but I don't do it. But I say it because I don't want to hold it in. That's what I was doing before, is I would hold everything in as if, you know, I had to. That was something I needed to do for whatever reason. And that message I got from my parents, because my family didn't talk about anything of substance. We, to this day, still don't talk about anything of substance. You know, my father died coming up to 2 years ago now, and we really didn't talk about his death. We still haven't really talked about his death because we don't talk about things in my family. I attempt to talk about them with my mother and my sister, but they don't want to go there. They say, why do you bring that up? Why do you talk about those things? So that's kind of how my family is we don't talk about things. And so I think I used food to deal with the fact that I wasn't able to, you know, learn how to navigate my feelings. And so it was really a big struggle for me when I was younger. I wasn't someone who ever wanted to lose weight. The only time I ever lost weight was when my mother forced me to go on a diet, and then I would torture her with, you know, you better feed me when I want to be fed. And I remember one specific time, dinner wasn't ready at a certain time, and I sat in the kitchen and just glared at her and, like, you know, talked in a very loud voice, you better be getting done this soon, because, you know, I wanted to eat. That was what I wanted, and that's what I told myself I needed. And so that was something I did. As I said, I found someone who brought me into program. I started recovery. You know, I have kept my recovery very simple. People say that I'm even obsessive about my recovery in that way, but I eat the same meals over and over and over again. I don't want to have to think about food, and I find my food to be very satisfying, so why shouldn't I do what works for me? It's not about living my life making other people, even people in recovery, happy. It's about what I found that works for me. And, you know, that's what I do. And so if people don't like the way I, you know, eat the same things over and over again, so what? It's not their life. You know, that's what I like about recovery. Each person's recovery is their own recovery. It's about you, your higher power, and your sponsor. It's not about making everyone else happy. That's how I used to live my life, is I used to make them all happy. My mom and my dad and my sister and everyone else in my life, I had to make everyone else happy. And I couldn't do that because I was always told that I'm bad and there's something wrong with me. And because there's something wrong with me, it makes me even more bad. So that's why I ate, because I didn't have any outlet for letting those feelings out. Now I do. I mean, I've actually totally changed my career. I'm now a psychotherapist. Before, I used to be an accountant. That, you know, made a big change in my life. I got into therapy, which really helped me change a lot of my attitudes about myself and my struggles and things that are going on in my life. I've been really working on and struggling with dealing with the fact that I'm gay, because that's another thing that my family did not really appreciate about me. So I'm really delving into the depths of that, and that's been really difficult. On top of what's going on with COVID, it's really brought up a lot of my isolation and my feelings of fear and anger and, you know, just not knowing what I'm going to do and feeling very lonely and alone. But what I've discovered for me, it's not the loneliness that's the problem. It's I get caught up with that part of me that feels alone and think that that's always the way it's going to be. I lose sight of my higher power at some times. As I said earlier, I don't ever have the feeling that I am not going to be okay, because I have that connection, or I've been very fortunate to have a connection to my higher power so early in recovery that I know everything is going to be okay. Even if I'm in the moment of something where I'm telling myself it's not going to be okay. I think in the back of my mind, there's always this feeling that, wow, this is going to, you're going to be okay. You're going to survive this. Even if it looks very messy and very clunky, you're going to be okay. And so I just really hold on to that, even during COVID. You know, there for a while when when COVID started first happening here in Los Angeles, you know, there was a day where grocery stores were running out of food. So, you know, I went there and I bought all the food that I needed for a couple of weeks, and then I realized, you know, I'm going to be okay. And I stopped being, going out there and fear buying, if you want to call it that. You know, I thought, you know, this is not a kind of a disaster where we're not going to have access to electricity and water, and things are going to still be made. You know, it's not the same as if you have a hurricane or, an earthquake or a fire or something like that, where your actual, ability to do things is gone. So when I had that realization again and I reconnected to my higher power that you're going to be okay, I stopped impulse and fear buying. And I was just doing what I normally do, which again is I stayed focused on the same foods that I eat all the time. And lo and behold, there was always enough for me. There has always been enough. I've not had to worry about it. But as I said, I just keep it very simple. That to me is the most important thing, is I have to keep it very simple and focus on what works for me. And that's, made the biggest decision or biggest change in my life. I'm someone who spends a lot of time alone anyway, so, having to isolate at home has not really been that big of a change for me. But what I've noticed is I actually miss going to in-person meetings and seeing the people that I saw there. I've been doing Zoom meetings mainly. I like that. That's better than nothing, but I really do miss being around the energy that's in live meetings. We're very fortunate here in California. I don't know where other people are from, but we're very fortunate. For many years, we had a lot of live meetings that I could go to. And so I just missed having that, fellowship and that camaraderie of being with other people. I really miss that. Unfortunately, it's not going to happen anytime soon, as far as I know. But that's something I think is very, valuable. So this is just from coming from being on the board and all that, that I encourage people, when we're able to go back to in-person meetings, if you don't have them in your area, please consider starting them. Yes, phone bridge meetings are important and they do help, but there's just something about being around other compulsive eaters and seeing each other. Again, something that Ray Z used to always say, and it's reiterated by Pamela, who was the president of CHOW for many years. She always reiterates this, that Ray Z used to always say, we stand up when we speak, because for so many years we hid, and so we don't hide anymore. So that's why I think it's important to actually go to in-person meetings, because, you're there and you're being seen. And that's such a big part for people who've been compulsive eaters, is a lot of times they don't want to be seen. I know I didn't want to be seen. It's like the other woman who just spoke before me. She said, she didn't want to be seen. Oh, sorry. I was just on a Zoom meeting before this one, and she said this, that, she didn't want to be seen, so she did a lot of things by herself and isolated herself. But deep down inside, she really wanted to be a part of something. And I had a very similar reaction in my life. But that was something I always wanted to do. So I know that there's a part of me that likes to be alone a lot of times, but there are also times that I like to be with other people. And I think that's something I really miss about being in the pandemic, is I don't have connections with other people. I am fortunate in the fact that my job is an essential job. I actually have to go to my office 3 days a week. We have individual offices, so we don't have a lot of interaction, but I do get to see some people there, and that does help. I was someone who used to go out to lunch every day to one specific restaurant. That restaurant has now gone out of business, so I've had to adapt a little of my food. I actually go to the grocery store and buy things now. I tend to buy things in, packages that are the size of things that I need. So my stuff is weighed and measured when I buy it. I'm very fortunate. Again, I like to keep things really simple. I'm a man who lives by myself. I don't have to, deal with anyone else, so I can do that. I just buy things in, the quantities and qualities that I need, and I just keep it simple, and it works for me, and I'm really glad for that. But as I said, I do miss having connection with people. That's been a big challenge. Even talking to people on the phone is not quite the same. But, you know, I get through, and as I said before, I know I'm going to be okay. Regardless of what's happening, I'm going to be okay. Not that I want to get COVID, but if I get it, I think I'll still be okay. You know, I am one of those people that's in the high-risk area. I don't know. You know, there's a part of me that feels like I'd still be okay. Even, sorry, this is going to sound morbid. Even in death, I would still be okay. Not that I want to die. But, you know, that's still kind of how I tell myself what's going on. So I'm going to thank being asked to speak here today, and I guess that's my time. Thanks.
Okay, thank you, Tom. This is Linda M., compulsive eater. Again, if you're just joining us, I want to welcome you to the workshop and remind everyone that we are being recorded. Please do not use your last name or your phone number. And our next person is Julianne.
Hi, I'm Julianne. I'm a compulsive eater and bulimic.
How did you know to time you?
What is the time? 15?
Yes.
5:05 is great. Thank you.
Okie dokie.
Okay. Like I said, Julianne, compulsive eater and bulimic. Looking back on my life, I have always felt different, but it wasn't until I was much older that I realized that that was depression and that nobody else in my family had that, which has been the major difficulty in my life. And I think the first time I ever ate something with sugar and flour in it, I think I couldn't stop. And that was at a really young age, and nobody else in my family had that problem either. And my dad was a psychiatrist, and he thought therapy would help this problem. And somehow I knew, even when I was super young, I mean, he tried to send me to therapists, I mean, even when I was a child, for other things. But, he didn't know it was depression until I was much older. But somehow I knew as a child that no human power could help me. I didn't know it in those words, though. I couldn't have told you in those words. I couldn't be, I just somehow I know, I knew somehow there was no hope. I knew that maybe because my parents had tried, and somehow I felt like this obsession and compulsion. So my entire childhood was really ruined by this disease because my main focus, I was an addict, and I focused on eating things, and my parents and family tried to control it, and I got larger and larger, which I absolutely hated being a heavy kid. You know, I liked being active, and of course being heavy can, in, you know, make that more difficult. But my friends were thin, and I always thought they looked so cute in their knee socks and short skirts, and I'd wear them, and they wouldn't look so cute on me. But the one thing that kind of saved me in my childhood is I loved horses. I loved riding horses. I can remember the first time I ever went to, like, Beverly Playland, we used to call it, and my dad put me on a pony, and I wanted lightning. I wanted thunder. I wanted the fastest one. So I guess I'm a bit of an adrenaline junkie, too. But after riding for many, many years, my parents finally got me a horse when I was about 10. And I don't really remember being depressed between 10 and 16, but I think that's because I was eating. And then I started using drugs when I was 11 because I have three older brothers, and my brother closest in age gave me pot when I was like 11. And I don't remember the depression between those years, but I certainly was eating compulsively, and I tried dieting. I mean, you know what? It was really hard because I've heard other people who grew up in families where people tried, like the parents, and I'm Jewish, and I'm the youngest, and I'm a girl. My parents weren't those kind of parents that stuffed food on you. They were, my dad was a doctor, and my mom was well-educated, and they served really healthy food. It's not like there wasn't any sugar or flour in the house. It wasn't like there wasn't enough food. My brothers would always laugh about that. They still laugh about that because it's so funny. My brother closest in age, he's 4.5 years older than me, always has way too much food at his house. But so I don't always identify with stuff like that. But I felt like really unhappy that they weren't happy with me. And also because of the depression and the weight, I was not happy, so my behavior wasn't good. You know, when I was really young, well, not just young, as a child and until I got sober at age 23, I stole money from my parents. I mean, at first it was just that change out of my dad's change thing he had to buy things at the liquor store, and then later on it became a lot of money to buy drugs. But when you're doing that, even taking a quarter or a dollar from your parents, at least for me, I felt bad about myself. And hiding food, I remember I hid something in my closet, and my mom found it, and she never told me till later, but it was something that's really just pure sugar and fat and with a spoon, and she just, like, that really affected her deeply, but, you know, to me, it was no big deal. Like, yeah, you know, my drugs are in the closet. I mean, I didn't think that as a kid, but that's how it felt to me. And I was just at a meeting, another meeting, where someone shared in second grade she did this, but in third grade I did this. I would sneak into the classroom at recess and take out all the sweets from other kids' lunches because my mom was trying to control my weight. So she might give them to my brothers, but she didn't give those things to me. And
that's 5 minutes.
I was an addict, so I had to find them. Did you say that was 5?
Yes.
I don't want it. Okay. Okay. So eventually I got into recovery at 23 through, I got to say that the pot led to all kinds of drugs, and by the time I was 23, I was on heroin and methadone, and I was 250 pounds. And one of the reasons I started using heroin was all the kids in Hollywood, because I went into the punk rock scene. My poor parents. I mean, they had this 250-pound heroin addict daughter who had, you know, looked like, I feel so bad for them, but my mom was always so supportive, and my dad was kind of embarrassed. But I went into recovery, and I met a nurse while I was detoxing. I was there for 49 days in the care unit, and one of the nurses was a recovering bulimic, and she took me to my first OA meeting, and I felt like I had started to have spiritual experiences, and that's really what has changed my life. Like, I didn't have any concept of a God when I was a child. My parents, I wouldn't say they were atheists. They were not, but they, and I don't even know to call them agnostic. They just didn't believe in God, but they never marched around with that theme. They just thought when you're dead, you're dead. They didn't believe in heaven, hell, all that stuff. But you know what? They live. My parents have always lived. My dad is dead now, but my mom and father always lived by spiritual principles. I don't know why they were born with that book, but you know, I wasn't. So, when I started at spiritual experiences, one of the first ones was they gave me the third step prayer to read. And somehow I just was really taken. I was 23 at the time. I was really taken by victory over my difficulties so I could help others. And that is such a cool concept because I was so selfish and self-centered at that time in my life and until that period and even after that, because to me that's been a slow unraveling of selfishness and self-centeredness, because I think as a compulsive eater and an addict, that's my basic, you know, go-to without a program of recovery. So that was something I remember when reading that, I just had a spiritual experience. And also they gave me something that was back in OA that was called Cease Fighting, but it's from, you know, the big book, Cease Fighting Everything and Everyone, and that one day we would recoil from those foods, like from a hot flame. And God, what a promise that was. And that is actually, I don't even recoil like them. It's like I've been placed in a neutrality for those foods because I haven't eaten. Now it's been over 25 years since I've had sugar and flour. But, I've been in how, so that OA turned into how eventually, because the doctor I was seeing, who was the one who detoxed me at the care unit, told me he had patients that were doing really well in this thing called HAO. So I started going to that. I don't know where I got the willingness, probably because when I had a year clean, I got to my top weight of 336 pounds, and that was having done 6 months in OA, and I just felt like I was going to use drugs again if I didn't do something about the food. And I was only 23 or 24, and I could barely turn over in bed. And 250, I could handle it at a young age, but when I got over 300, it was super uncomfortable. And I'm not very tall. I'm only 5'5", and it just was too much. And so I had the willingness, even though people would tell me to pray for the willingness, and I can remember getting off the sugar and flour, and quantity wasn't easy. But I've had great sponsorship, and I, you know, did the steps, and I did the inventory, and my sponsors told me, you know, that you were building a foundation and that you better do this well. Don't do it skimpily. Make it really, you know, concrete. Make it strong. And I don't have time to go into my whole story because my story does involve relapse and in both programs, and that has been devastating. But what I have gotten to see out of those relapses, and it's not like I didn't know this, but that it is a fatal disease and it's a progressive disease. And I believe that when you told me that, because at 23, I had already been eating compulsively for 20 years, and I needed a solution. I knew, I really am so lucky. I feel so grateful that Hal came to me at that age, that I was introduced to Hal, and that I took to it, because a lot of times people just don't take the 12-step programs. But I did, and that's when I started my path of recovery, and it's been slow and steady with setbacks. And I ended up getting about, I had 1 year. Is that five again?
So you have five minutes left, yes.
Okay. So anyway, I was just going to say I did gain my weight back once after losing 185 pounds, which I maintained for 4 years, but I did gain it back, and then in another stay at a hospital, I became bulimic, and once a pickle, never a cucumber, but I still am a terrible bulimic. But I always identify as that because that did happen to me, and it's really like much worse than just being a compulsive eater. So what it's like today in this pandemic, you know, I've been going to Hal since 1986. So I still feel like every day, you know what, the truth is I have a lot of history of weighing and measuring my food. And even though today I only have a little over 8 months again, although I have, like I said, I hadn't had sugar and flour in 25 years, I have had 14 and a half years of abstinence. I've had 6 years. I've had 8 years. You know, I've had a year and a half. And I would say in the last 34 years, I have been abstinent much more. I mean, almost completely compared to the relapses I've had. I have the tools, and I've had relapses with the drugs, which were super devastating because they took me really far away from God, even though I was abstinent, attending meetings, had a sponsor that I was honest with, was sponsoring women I was honest with about my drug relapse. And I thank God that they stuck with me, because I don't know what would have happened if I hadn't been able to stay in this program while I lost strong foundation, because I had 22 and a half years of sobriety the last time I relapsed. And I had that such great habits, you know, and I'd learned so much here that even though I was using drugs, I was able to stay abstinent and sponsor other people, even though they knew I was using. It sounds crazy, but this is what happened. And today I still struggle with being of service. That's not really true. I mean, it organically, it came through service in the program, and I have been intergroup rep and vice chair of the intergroup and chair of the intergroup and a delegate and stuff like that. And that just came organically, too. I couldn't push myself into those positions. It sort of, for me, unfolded that I became more and more willing to be of service. And today, my 92-year-old mother moved in with me in April. I can't believe it's almost a year since my father died. In 10 days, it'll be a year that he died, and I was very close to him. But she moved in with me at the end of April, and you know, it's not easy. She doesn't hear well. She needs a lot of help. It's just she pushes my buttons because she installed them. She's very controlling and codependent and has anxiety, but she's also an incredible person. As a mother, when I was young, she was a wonderful to to be what she is, and I need to adapt, and I need to accept her as she is, and I need to change. I mean, it's taken me almost 35 years to see that I know that I can't change other people as much as I may want to. You know, every morning out of bed, I pray. I slip onto my knees out of bed. I roll onto my knees, and I say the third step prayer and the seventh step prayer, and I ask God for the PPP, which is pause, proceed, pause, pray, and proceed. And I ask God to help me with that pause, because I have another person in the program, I've heard her say that God is in the pause, because I am reactive. I can forget that I have a 12-step program. And then to me, that's embarrassing, because my family knows I've been in recovery for this long. So they're not in recovery. None of them are in a 12-step program. And so I'm the only example they see of it, including my son. And I am sometimes very embarrassed by my behavior. It's very easy for me to weigh and measure my food. I weigh everything on a scale, including dressing, because I don't like to clean little instruments in the sink. But I don't have any problem doing that, because I need that perimeter. I mean, Hal has been an amazing gift to me, to find out that I had a disease, that there was a solution, because as a child, I didn't know anybody else in the world suffered the way I did, from depression, compulsive eating, bulimia. I didn't know there were other people suffering and that there was a solution. So to find a group of people in recovery with a solution is a tremendous gift, because I know there are many people that don't have that. And I do carry the message, but mostly when people ask for help through sponsorship. And if someone has never been in a 12-step program and finds out I've lost that much weight, I have no problem telling them how. I don't have a problem with my anonymity, because I'm anxious to help people if they want a solution, but I certainly don't go out looking for recruits or anything like that. Because when I was overweight, and I was severely overweight, I was kind of like that monkey, see no evil, hear no evil, speak no evil. Don't tell me I'm fat. Like, you have to tell me I'm fat. Like, I don't know. Sorry about the dog. I was completely in denial about my weight. The body dysmorphic disorder was like, when I was heavy, I thought I was thinner than I was. And when I'm thin, I think I'm heavier than I am. And so once in a while, I think I see myself as others might see me, but that's rare. I don't know how you see me. And I only know how I feel inside. And this disease, Cindy, this disease is relentless. You know, I don't find that just because I have recovery from compulsive eating, that I have recovery from all parts of this disease, which include body dysmorphic disorder and, you know, let's just add, for lack of a better word, alcoholic thinking, that I have a solution. You know, I have 12 steps and 12 traditions, and I apply the traditions to at home, and I think of, you know, the common welfare instead of just what's great for Julianne, because, like I said, my nature is total self-centeredness, and that's the biggest gift I have gotten from all these years in recovery, and it's taken a long time. I'm so jealous when I see people with a year, and they're so far ahead of where I was at a year, like really far ahead, because it's taken me many years to organically become more of service, where it's not like twisting my arm to get me to be of service. It's almost like a gift. I can't even believe I'm saying that. I mean, that is a miracle right there. So I just want to say today, even though it's smoky and horrible in California, because I love to exercise, it helps my depression immensely, and I can't do that right now, but I'm full of gratitude to not be consumed with food, and that weighing and measuring and committing my food and working with a sponsor and having sponsees and going to meetings are gifts of recovery, and I'm really grateful for that. So thank you for letting me share.
Thank you so much, Julianne. Thank you for joining us, and our final speaker for the day is Paul from New York.
Hi, this is Paul from New York. I'm there here. Just,
how would you like to be
timed? Too many things at once. You can give me a 5 minute and a 1 minute.
Okay, will do. Thank you.
Thank you so much. You know, it was very eventful today, starting at noontime. Well, actually, it started earlier than that. It started this morning at 6 a.m. when I got up, and I was just listening to the meeting. And, you know, getting back to my recovery, I'm just so grateful that I have that luxury right now, that at any given time in the morning, in the afternoon, in the evening, I can switch on recovery by just making a phone call. My name again is Paul. I'm a compulsive eater from New York. I've been in C House since April 15th, 03, with back-to-back. My program, for the most part, has been structured from the early on and has maintained the same, you know, sustenance until, obviously, I you know, grew a little older in my recovery and needed to make some tweaking. But one of the things about this weekend and, you know, having the topic of, you know, which is so current, you know, how to stay abstinent during these, you know, particular times, and we have, you know, labeled it the pandemic this time. Friday was 9/11, and I didn't have a food fellowship or program. It probably helped me 2 years later, you know, come into this program, because I needed something at that point, and it wasn't going to be alcohol, and it wasn't going to be cigarettes, and it wasn't going to be some of the other things that I'd put before my God. And so when, you know, I came into this program, I might have come from lower numbers from some other, you know, people that I saw and witnessed in recovery. One of the nice things about early recovery is that the live meetings, you know, you got to see the person in person, but you also got to see the pictures of where they came from and where they were now. I bring up the 9/11 because, yet again, there are so many, you know, outside issues that can, you know, hamper or bring, you know, difficulty to our recovery. But I bring back my early stages of recovery, too, because I was also, for the first time, diagnosed with two serious complications. One was cancer, and the other thing was diabetes. Two things I never, you know, imagined having to, you know, deal with, because I was so busy with everything else in my recovery. And I went to, you know, luckily, you know, the same meetings, and found people that were finding some, you know, help through this particular program, so I didn't have to do a lot of investigating, but I'm grateful that they were there, and I feel that that has always been somewhat of the way, and where I am still now, that when, you know, we need something, the answer somehow appears, and that also comes from, you know, getting our hands up and sharing it in our recovery rooms, and letting people know where we're at, so that, you know, if we do need help or an outside help, we can get it hopefully from sharing that information with one another. So bringing up, you know, the early stages of my recovery and going through somewhat of the plan, I found that, you know, I stayed regimental with the program. And it was very much structured with using, you know, the tools that were added as far as, like, having a scale, having spoons, having all those things, you know, to cook with. And also luxury of having live meetings, which is interesting because now, you know, we don't. And we haven't had a lot of live meetings for a long time, but of the very few that were left, those were also, you know, put on hold because of this particular, you know, place that we're at again. So so grateful that there was, you know, people that had stepped up during the period of the early stages of my recovery till now to just always have a door open for my recovery. I want to say that once I started hearing about the situation that was happening, I got a full dose of, you know, fear from a lot of people that were really taking very strong, you know, things to they were very, very frightened. And one of the things that I have tried to do in all these different particular cases and all the different things that have happened in the past, and, you know, I mentioned 9/11 on Friday, that was an anniversary date of 19 years. We also had a major storm come through New York in which, you know, I went through a period of a blackout for over 2 weeks and in the middle of the winter, you know, and knowing that in all these specific circumstances, including, you know, family losses of, you know, father and mother and others in my family, that this has stayed the most consistent, that I have never waned. You know, I have found from my other recovery that you don't pick up no matter what. You look for, you know, whatever tools that are going to be available here in this room. And so what I did in my early stages of recovery is not, you know, to shrug anything, but I knew that I had to do service. And so along with trying to get up, and it was pretty nonstop at that time. I could get up at, you know, 5:30 and be on that first meeting and listen in. I also found a lot of, you know, time on my hands, and I felt that too many meetings were causing a lot of personality, you know, issues for myself. So I had to cut back. And so I pretty much hit maybe one or two meetings in the morning, and I do have other recovery that happens at night now. Just trying to put it all together, because it's unbelievable that 6 months has passed and I still can claim a seat here in this room. I saw a lot firsthand because, you know, a lot of people that were, you know, staying in place, I also would do that for the most part, but I also put myself out there in the streets. And I want to say that I'm grateful that I'm still here. I'm so grateful that I learned a lot for my recovery, that, you know, I could only do so much, but I also had to make sure that, you know, I had to deal with my own self-care, and was not really, you know, blindsided by what was happening, but there was so much in the early stages of this happening 6 months ago that I was awed by it at the same time. And part of it was because, you know, we were going from the winter months into the spring. So on a daily recollection of getting out there into the world and trying to help others that were, you know, in need of provisions or were, you know, stuck at home because they were ill, I would be going out to all these different places to gather, you know, provisions and start to separate it and putting it out for them in the doorsteps. At the same time, as I said, spring began to develop here in New York, and so you could just see the light through that tunnel, at least for me, going down our West Side Highway and constantly seeing, you know, things that I hadn't seen before, or just the awakening of life, even though there was so much, you know, things going around me. And also, and it was brought up by many people during that time, and I don't think it gets its play as much now, is that you would hear birds, and you would hear, you know, other, you know, forms of life besides myself. So getting back to, you know, the situation, I went on for about 4 months over and over again, relentlessly, day by day, just constantly, you know, looking what kind of service I could do. And that's also on the phone bridge, but also, you know, for my community. And in the midst of that, you know, I still had a, you know, sponsor. I still had to be, you know, accountable to my sponsor. That's also changed a little bit because they're not up at the, you know, crack of dawn like they used to be. And so I often get a sponsor that's partially waking up when I give him his call, but he's always got the time set so that he can take my food and to talk. But I just constantly was looking over and over again, as I said, for ways to do service. And that is also how I, you know, came into this program. You know, I might have come in a little resistant, especially when I had to switch from live meetings to phone bridge, you know, over 10, maybe even longer than that, years ago when, you know, many of our meetings disbanded here in New York. But I knew that it was the only way that I was going to be able to, you know, claim my seat and to continue to stay abstinent in my recovery. And earlier today, I was at a sponsorship committee meeting, and, you know, we were discussing that there are so many people out there with different ways of sponsoring. There is no one way. But I know that for myself, you know, I was always just putting it out there for the ones that I, you know, was working with, that I was out there, and I was trying to do what I could, but at the same time, was not putting myself in any kind of, you know, harm. I mean, I made sure that I also, you know, followed the guidelines that are out there while I was out there. Thank you so much for my recovery. So I just wanted to put it in three parts. Before this happened, I got a lot of information from people that were scared. And one of the things that kept me going is that, you know, I'm not gonna fold to fear. I made sure that at that time, you know, as I said in my second part, during, to stay as close to service as I possibly could, and that meant in the rooms and also outside there, you know, in my life outside the rooms. Lastly, you know, as we're at the, not the tail end, but at least the last, you know, months where a lot of the fear of, you know, the numbers that we were dealing here with New York and you know, I've come back to realize that self-care is also important in recovery and also being of service because, you know, if I was out there drowning, you know, I'd have to make sure that I get myself anchored somehow onto, you know, some kind of, you know, life raft or whatever and get myself back on, you know, ground and get my feet, you know, planted in a strong recovery program. So I had to, at that point, do less. And it hurt. It was very hard to, you know, say goodbye to a lot of the, you know, the many faces and many people that I met along the way in the last 6 months. But I knew that if I didn't get myself set up for some self-care here, I was going to lose my abstinence. I, you know, was beginning to think, you know, having those little squirrely thoughts on how I could do this, and that wasn't helping me in my recovery. So I still have a couple people that I serve outside of the rooms. I still make sure that I have commitments. In the process of the last 6 months, I've tried to keep the light on here in New York and also to bring it to the community of, you know, the rest of the United States and beyond by offering two live meetings that come on different days here. They come at a specific time when most times there's not meetings. So for those that that have shared at my meeting, some of them say that this was the time when, you know, there wasn't a meeting and I thought about picking up, and I'm so grateful that there was some place where I could go. So I'm keeping the light on here in New York with two additional meetings. I've cut back on a lot of my service to just two that I focus on Thursdays, which is all about the concept and all about the tools, which I feel are very pertinent to anybody's recovery. I mean, along with any of the AA literature, our concepts and our tools are beyond, you know, anything that I could ever experienced in my recovery as far as peeling layers. You know, I'm still, you know, anxious to grow in this program even 17 years later. And so also a commitment to, you know, making more outreach calls instead of just texting a lot. I mean, I do a lot of, you know, putting my focus out there to, you know, many of the people that I know through, you know, letting them know about my meeting and also seeing how they are. But just making sure that I do get a lot of calls per day, and some people feel slighted sometimes that they haven't heard from me, but I'm always trying to, you know, fast forward and get to as many people as I possibly can. and along with self-care, be honest with myself as to what I can and cannot do. I think we're very lucky, you know, because as I said, we will always have outside issues. We'll always have something that comes up that can definitely, you know, deter us wanting to stay in this program or staying abstinent. But I can't imagine a life without this program guiding me through those, you know, practical, you know, just anything. And as I said, we've had a couple of things before I just specifically spoke up, but on any given day, there is something out there that could, you know, damper our ability to stay in this program. And so we must look for, you know, the advice of those that are on, you know, we listen in on different meetings, we have our concept, we have the tools, and we have each other. Thanks for letting me share.
Thank you so much, Paul. And I want to thank all of our speakers today. We had Adele, Sonia Sunshine, Suzanne Kay, Tom P., Julian, and Paul from New York. If you would all go ahead and give them some applause, a little bit of love from wherever you are. And at this point, I'm going to stop the recording.